we got a very miraculous email one summer that said the funding had been approved, and we were all like, no, it hasn't.
Hello, and welcome to episode 9 of the Bandwagon Podcast for the week of April 22nd, 2024. On this edition of the program, news and notes from around the band world, including good news or new goods for a couple of college bands. A titan of the Massachusetts music education community passes away. A brief reminder of what 4 years ago felt like in the band world. And I have a conversation with a local college band director, and given the content of this podcast so far, it might not be the one you think. I'm your host, Rob Hamerton. Hello, dear listener. Right up front, I'm going to let you know, my interview this week is with a really interesting, really talented, and really wise musician and educator. Because our talk was so dang cool, I had a hard time editing it. I wanted to leave it all in. But our whole conversation lasted just north of an hour and three quarters, and let's just say there are podcasts that routinely last for several hours, and I don't want to put you through that. I just don't. So I've made sure the other segments of this week's episode are more concise, something I could stand to do more often anyway. Everybody wins. So tape up your rifles, and away we go. Let's play the first strain. In this episode's first strain, news and notes from the band world. Dateline, Iowa City, Iowa. The University of Iowa Hawkeye bands have been in, or at least adjacent to, the news this spring with the success of the Iowa women's basketball team. But here's a news item that's about the band specifically. As part of the University of Iowa's annual fundraising effort, One Day for Iowa, two financial donations totaling $40,000 were designated for use by the Hawkeye marching band. The band plans to use those funds to purchase a line of alto and tenor saxophones, which will be used on game days beginning this fall. The new instruments will be purchased in memory of Hawkeye Marching Band alum Stacy Thompson. Dateline, Fulton, Missouri. William Woods University has announced plans to establish a band program to begin operations this coming fall as a marching band and then to transition into pep band and concert band functions at the end of football season. They actually made the announcement back in October, but this podcast didn't exist then, so we're catching up. William Woods president, Dr. Jeremy Moreland, said, quote, adding an official William Woods band will significantly add to our campus culture, build school spirit, and provide new arts opportunities for our prospective students. And it fits right into our ongoing commitment of improving the total campus experience of all of our students, both inside and outside the classroom. In addition to plans for establishing athletic and concert band activity, a jazz band and chamber ensembles are also being considered. Dr. Alex Kirby, assistant professor in the university's School of Humanities, has been actively recruiting new band ensemble members through serving as a clinician at area high school band rehearsals and attending marching band competitions to connect with area directors and students. Kirby said, quote, it truly is an exciting time for the arts at William Woods. So many institutions across the nation are cutting the arts, and to see William Woods actively investing in them is exciting to see. The 150-year-old university plans to recruit at least 18 members for the band's first year of 2024-2025, building to eventually having around 70 to 80 members. Students will have an opportunity to audition for band scholarships of up to $5,000. Last May, the university also announced the addition of its first ever intercollegiate football program, which will begin play this fall. Last August, the university also welcomed its largest incoming class, 456 students, with 298 residential students and 158 online. So that 70 to 80 member band estimate is not, I would judge, too small. Last month, the university began construction on a new multi-sport stadium which will house that inaugural football team. The stadium will also house men's and women's soccer teams and the new women's flag football team. It's expected to seat around 2,500 spectators with an enclosed press box and an artificial turf playing field. The turf field will keep the Woods athletic teams from needing to travel up to 30 miles off campus to play home games in inclement weather, as they used to. Needless to say, most listeners of this podcast will recognize this stadium element's immediate benefit to the marching band. According to university officials, the new stadium will be completed by June. And an editorial thought here. Your ears do not deceive you. They expect to build a stadium in 3 months. We'll keep an eye on that effort. Another editorial thought occurred to me. The announcement of the establishment of a new band came this past October. The football home opener is scheduled for September 14. If this venture is successful, will it set records for zero to band in the shortest amount of time? Anyone have any experience with this? Let me know. And that's news and notes from the band world for this week. If you have a news item you think should be included in this segment, send me a link via email to heybandwagon@yahoo.com. Now we'll take a quick break and meet you on the other side with more Bandwagon. Okay, let's take the second strain. In this week's second strain, as promised, a eulogy to a titan of the music education community in Massachusetts, from me, someone who barely knew him. In the mid-2000s, I got involved with the Massachusetts Music Educators Association in a capacity that was more than just being a dues-paying member by way of joining the All-State Concert Committee. I was the assistant manager, and then a year later, the manager of the All-State Concert Band. In so doing, I got to rub elbows with some of the leading lights of the Massachusetts music ed community at the time. Some of them were on the concert committee, others I interacted with by association with that group. Just about any time I would cross paths with people like Jeff Leonard or Lavetta Studley, and Massachusetts music teachers will know who I'm referring to here, and those people would wave and say, "Hey, Rob," as if they actually knew me or something, well, I had a tiny bit of a fanboy moment. I would think to myself, they're all justly famous people, and yet they're so genuinely pleasant to little old me, a relative upstart in the music ed world. Paul Alberta, talk about a titan of the industry, an absolute legend of Massachusetts music education to the point that as a high school music student, I knew his name, left us early this month at the age of 82, a justly famous gentleman indeed. I don't have a great volume of Paul Alberta anecdotes, just one really. One of my tasks as All-State band manager was to find people to judge the All-State auditions. A number of people left me clues as to who would probably be willing, and I sent them emails and got responses. Happily accept, sadly decline. I asked Mr. Alberta, calling him Mr. Alberta, if he would be willing to be the clarinet audition room guy. He replied by email, "Hi, Rob. I would be delighted to adjudicate the Massachusetts All-State auditions. Thank you for asking. Send me all related information." I hoped that he was smiling when he typed that. It sure seemed like it. But I remembered seeing him at an All-State conference a few years before that, and he had looked gruff. So I didn't get my hopes up overly. On All-State audition day, everything went pretty smoothly, if I remember correctly, except that the clarinet auditions were progressively later and later than their assigned times as the day went on. "Oh," said someone, I don't remember who, "that's Paul. He spends a little more time with auditioners than anybody else. We'll see if we can goose him a little bit." They couldn't, but that's not the point of this story. Auditions finished up, and as it happened, the All-State band clarinet section that year was very good. Its section leader was phenomenal, and I mean that. And the young man had an opportunity to show off that skill in an extended clarinet solo mid-program. And in the back of the rehearsal room, a number of us traded glances and said, "Good call, Paul." Well, I still called him Mr. Alberta, even though he wasn't even in the room. A few days after the All-State concert was over, I sent emails of gratitude to all the people who had accepted my invitation to judge the auditions. The polite thing to do, as I had been taught. It wasn't the only reply I got from any of them, but Mr. Alberta's reply came back. "Hi, Rob. Thanks for the kind words. Very much appreciated. I'm glad that the clarinet section performed well. Let me know if I can again be of assistance to you next year. Have a great summer." He, a busy fellow, could have dashed off a quick, perhaps one or two word note, say, "Thanks, man," and it would have been fine by me. But instead, he sent a note that, to my eye, definitely had been written while smiling. I fanboyed out again. More than 4 years later, and I do not for the life of me remember what the occasion was, I crossed paths with him, for only the second time ever. He recognized me, and I refer you back to the beginning of this segment and my thoughts about justly famous people. And we conversed briefly, during which time he said to me, "I still have your email." You know, the one I'd sent to thank him for crafting a kick-ass All-State clarinet section. He remembered that little detail. He'd kept that email. I marveled at the idea. I still marvel. I imagine, based on my meager experiences with Paul Alberta and the wealth of stories that I've heard and read in the 3 weeks since his passing, that the clarinet section of the Symphonic Band of the Great Beyond will now be thoroughly and comprehensively prepared, down to the last pitch and rhythm and nuance of expression. And they'll love every moment of it. Godspeed, Mr. Alberta. All right, let's observe a respectful grand pause, and on the other side of that, a conversation you will absolutely enjoy. Okay, let's modulate and get into the trio section. This week in the trio section, normally when we invoke the phrase friend of the podcast or program or whatever, it means they've been an interview guest repeatedly. And obviously the Bandwagon Podcast Project is not yet old enough to have return state visits. But I'm still willing to use this phrase to describe this week's conversation partner because right from the beginning, from day number one, when I whispered to the internet, I might give this thing a go, she has been nothing but supportive and raw and go team. Clearly, her resume gets a little more involved than that. She's a saxophonist, an educator, a conductor. She's got endorsement deals with Yamaha and D'Addario and Rovner products. And if you're listening in Massachusetts or southern New Hampshire, she's a local college band director. Oh, and she's a bagpiper as well. So I'm looking forward to talking about any or all of that today with her. So welcome to the program, Dr. Amy McLaughlin. Amy.
Hi, Rob. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you aboard. We have talked about this for a little while.
We have.
As you say, I work. With all those resume points, we could go anywhere with this. And the setup you've got, your current teaching hitch, is one that I've actually heard and experienced live in person a little bit. And it is of interest to me because I'm not sure how common it really is. But first, let's introduce you further to our listenership by way of a few quickfire questions. Big mystery here. We've already given it away. What's your primary instrument?
Well, my primary instrument is saxophone. I am a woodwind doubler. I play clarinet as well, and I can make noise on a flute and push down buttons.
I have said a similar thing about a number of instruments. I have said things like, I can get beginners to chapter four.
There you go. There you go. That's about it for flute for me. Definitely not playing a Reed One book in a pit orchestra, but I'm happy on a Reed Three book any day.
I have occasionally thought, I'd love to play in a pit orchestra, but I literally can't.
I don't believe that.
I might be Reed 5 or 6.
If I was music directing a pit orchestra, I would definitely hire you.
Okay, I would want to see the book and just make sure there's not some English horn cue that I had to cover.
Just cover it on saxophone. It'll be fine.
I did play with a local high school's Into the Woods production, and I took the bassoon part, and I redid it for Barry Sachs. But I wasn't actually playing the actual bassoon because that also ain't happening.
Yeah, no. There's too many buttons for your thumb.
Thank you.
I can't keep track of all that. That's too much for me.
I have often thought you need at least two thumbs on each hand to make that thing work, seems like.
Yeah, I can barely keep track of a low C bass clarinet thumb work. So
I sat in the BU Wind Ensemble as a graduate student behind the bassoons, and I would occasionally glance and just go,
I want to push down one thing and know what's coming out.
Yes.
That's exactly why I don't play brass. I don't know how people teach brass. It blows my mind every day.
I taught beginner brass, and it was the most terrifying thing because I thought to myself, yeah, and I started on trumpet in fourth grade and kind of moved away from it because of reasons, mostly range reasons. But yeah, okay, kids, so C, this is C, and this is also G, and here's how we're going to get you there.
Yeah, when there's more than one option for fingering.
Left hand one and two is an A. And let's not even talk about, can we not grouse about clarinets?
You know what? The clarinet would be the perfect instrument if it were a saxophone. It's got a better range. It has a beautiful sound. Why can't it just have saxophone closed holes and fingerings?
I see why the clarinet and the saxophone are in the same room.
The similarities end at the single reed, in my opinion.
And when I went to teach beginner clarinet, I grabbed hold of a clarinet and I went after it, and I didn't understand why my saxophone embouchure was not helping me.
Right.
Oh, okay. So I'm looking forward, but my clarinet is playing downward and that makes it better. Oh, but it took me an afternoon to go, why can't I do this? I went to college.
It's hard as an adult, you know, and I teach a lot of adults. Because we can intellectually understand how an instrument is supposed to work, and we can understand what we're supposed to do. And we think because intellectually we grasp that we should just be able to physically make it happen. Mm-hmm. And that's just not how it works. You know, whereas with little kids, they don't know and they don't care. So you just tell them what to do and they do it and they think it's fantastic. And you do that with an adult and it takes more repetitions because their neurons don't fire at the same rate as kids do.
Yeah.
And it just takes longer for an adult to learn these things. So it's frustrating for adults to learn an instrument if they've never done that before.
And the neural pathways are kind of set.
They are. I mean, your brain is literally wired for whatever you did between the ages of 9 and 14. You know, so I tell adults that if they played any instrument for any amount of time when they were smaller, you know, middle school age, that they're more likely to have success as an adult, even learning a brand new instrument. Someone who's never played an instrument at all, it's just going to take longer. I think it's helpful to kind of explain to them that you have to consider it a long pathway. It's a journey over time. And there is no, where am I supposed to be at this point? I've been playing for 6 months. Shouldn't I be further along?
Yeah.
You are wherever you are.
In the note that you made about teaching adults, I am reminded to kind of get back to the questions, and one of which is, what is your current band-related role?
Yes, so I am currently the director of bands at Fitchburg State University. In that role, I direct the concert band and the jazz band. I also teach music technology courses and also a general ed music lecture course every semester, which just depends on what is needed or what is in the schedule. Every other spring, I teach history of jazz, and every fall, I teach world music, and right now, I'm teaching a music appreciation class. So it just depends on what the department needs filled, but that is part of my role there.
What bands have you been active with in your life, whether it's playing or it's not?
Oh, my. So I have a list.
Yeah.
I have a list.
She's got a little list.
Yeah. So I'll go back to high school. So in high school, I was, of course, in the concert band. I was in the marching band. I was actually a drum major for 4 years in my marching band. I was in the jazz band. I also played in a community jazz band in high school that my band director got me involved with. They were out of a Methodist church in Manassas, Virginia, the St. Tomcats. I credit them with giving me an opportunity to really learn how to play in a jazz ensemble. I get to sit next to some really wonderful people and learned so much about jazz styles and how to play in a group from them. I went to college at Marshall University, and while I was there, I was in the Wind Symphony Jazz Ensemble, the marching band, the Marching Thunder. I was also the president of Kappa Kappa Psi there. I started a master's degree at the University of Florida. I was in the wind ensemble there. I was a marching band assistant. And now, I mean, you know, you graduate from college and there's no more band. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, we lose these opportunities to be in band once we get out of college. So I'm always seeking opportunities to play in an ensemble because I just don't get to do it very often anymore. So every summer, there's a wonderful wind ensemble in Maine, the Acadia Wind Ensemble. It's a two-day festival. We bring in Tony Maiello to conduct, and two solid mouth-aching days of rehearsal followed by a concert. And it's fantastic. So we go up for that, and it's a great way to kind of reconnect with friends and play some really great music. Also, the New England Band Directors Institute conference, which happens in New Hampshire, fabulous reading sessions. It's a great way for me to play with my colleagues, but also kind of get into my ears a lot of new music that is being published. So it serves a lot of purposes for me. And then lastly, you mentioned I also play bagpipes, and I'm the pipe major of the Clan McPherson Pipes and Drums in Lawrence, Massachusetts. And I also was a member of the Catamount Pipe Band in Vermont for a few years, where we traveled and competed in the World Pipe Band Championships in Glasgow, Scotland.
There's a musical activity that I know next to nothing about, and my father came from the UK, and I thought I was familiar with that sort of music, but it was an eye-opener. And yes, there's a version of DCI Finals for that.
There is. And I can tell you that pipe band world is filled with some of the best musicians I have ever heard. They are incredibly virtuosic players, technique-wise. And it's amazing because they all just have regular day jobs. They don't consider themselves professional musicians, and they play at some of the highest levels of musicianship and ensemble unity that I've ever heard.
And not just because I know you and that part of your musical life, but also because I would rather not have people tell jokes on my instrument. I try not to tell bagpipe jokes because, I mean, look.
I mean, there's a lot. You know, why do bagpipers march around and get away from the sound? Yeah, that's my favorite one.
That one I had not heard.
Really? Come on.
I heard the one involving the dumpster, but look, no. That.
They are incredibly loud. One set of Great Highland Pipes is 110 decibels.
Is it really?
Yes.
Which is a considerable percentage of a jet fighter sound.
Yes, that's definitely hearing damage range. More of us should be wearing earplugs.
And all that time I was pleased to see it when the percussionists in marching ensembles put in the earplugs, I thought, finally, because I know of examples of hearing loss there. And it wasn't until recently that I thought about the people in the middle of the brass block.
Yeah.
And then I hadn't really considered that one single instrument could be as loud as that. And okay.
Well, I mean, even violinists, they have a high percentage of hearing loss in their left ear.
Which makes a certain amount of sense, yeah.
You know, so, you know, the violin's resting on your left shoulder and it's closest to the sound. So, you know, even instruments that we think of as not being very loud over time can definitely cause hearing damage. In our household, we've invested a lot of money in high-end musician earplugs. Mm. And we use them pretty religiously.
And you are married to a brass player of our mutual acquaintance.
I am. And a brass player who has hearing loss as well. But we also don't know how long he has had that hearing loss. And we suspect he may have had it his whole life. So his hearing damage has not changed over time. He is missing a specific set of frequencies out of the mid-range of his hearing. So when you look at his hearing chart, it looks like a big V.
Interesting.
So yeah, he does wear a hearing aid, but he also wears earplugs now in rehearsals. And, you know, when your wife's in a pipe band, you get sucked into the pipe band. So now he has to play bass drum in my pipe band. So, I mean, he always has his earplugs in for that.
It's an impact, maybe a slightly less sharp impact than one of the snares or one of those similar drums, but no less of an effect, I would imagine.
Right, but he's also in the center of all that sound.
Mm.
You know, and we do rehearse indoors in a rather low-ceilinged room. It's not a band room. So it's kind of a high-pressure hearing situation in there.
A perfect storm for that sort of thing.
Very much so.
And I suppose I'm not sure which instrument I'm talking about with this, but how did you get into playing your band instrument?
All right. Well, you might actually find this story familiar. So when I was little, I always wanted to be a musician. I always knew that from the time I was 4 or 5 years old. Begged and begged my parents to let me take piano lessons. And when I turned 6, they bought a piano from our neighbor and brought it over in the pickup truck and rolled it into the house. And they found me a teacher, which I now realize was quite early, the age of 6. So I'm probably pretty lucky to have gotten that. But my two older brothers, played band instruments, and I wanted to play one too. And when I was going into the 6th grade, because that's when you start in Virginia, I originally wanted to play French horn. And my mom said, well, we already own a trumpet and a saxophone. You can pick one of those.
I'm hearing echoes. Keep going.
Right. Well, the trumpet was still being used by my brother who was in high school. So I was damn sure I wasn't sharing with him. So I took the saxophone and the rest is history.
So your musical life has taken you from Virginia to West Virginia to Florida to here in New England and eventually into the Massachusetts State University system. How does all that happen exactly?
It was a long and winding journey. I'll just put it that way. You know, I have 3 degrees in saxophone performance. While I have a ton of band leadership experience, I never really thought about becoming a band director as a career. And I'm not sure why, but I didn't. But, you know, you never know where life's going to take you. I had started a master's degree at the University of Florida. It wasn't really working out for me there. It wasn't the right place for me or the right time for me to be in a master's degree program. My experience in the band department there was fantastic. So I have nothing bad to say about that. In fact, some of the best friends of my entire life I made working with the University of Florida band. And still in touch with them and communicate with them on almost daily basis. But on a personal level, it just wasn't a good time for me to be getting my master's degree. And I took a break. I ended up moving to New England for a job. That job was outside of music. I was actually working in IT, and I worked in the IT world for about 7 or 8 years. I worked for a private financial firm in Boston, and I was really getting the itch to get back into music and get back into saxophone. And when I started doing my research, I realized that Ken Radnofsky is the person who teaches all the classical saxophonists in Boston. And I didn't know Ken at all. So I started poking around and I found someone nearby who was one of his former students. And so I called him up. I said, hey, this is where I am, and this is what I'm looking to do. And I was hoping I could, you know, maybe get some lessons with you so that I could get ready for some lessons with Ken. And he immediately said, oh, I think you should just study with Ken now. I'll call him for you. And I said, okay. And an hour later, Ken calls me and says, you know, my student called me and they told me your story and I would very much like to teach you. And I would like for you to come and play for me and you can decide if I'm the right teacher for you. He goes, because you're not auditioning for me, I'm auditioning for you.
Oh.
And I am suddenly having this revelation of this is the opposite of almost every experience I've ever had with teachers. So I said, well, okay. So I scheduled a lesson. I went and did my lesson and it was great. And I mean, keep in mind, I hadn't really played on a consistent basis for a number of years, like 5 or 6 years at that point. So, I mean, really was out of shape, but we scheduled some more lessons. And after about a month, this is like end of October of like 2003. And he says to me, so are you going to go back to school or what? You know, I mean, I've only taken like 3 lessons with the guy, right? So I said, well, I was thinking about, you know, taking lessons for a year and getting ready and then doing some auditions next year. And he says, you're ready now. He goes, application deadlines are December 1st. Let me know what you're doing next week. I came back the next week and I said, yeah, sure, let's do it. So, you know, I did auditions at all 3 conservatories in Boston. Longy, Boston Conservatory, New England Conservatory. I got into all 3. I got scholarship money at all 3. I ended up choosing to go to the Longy School. I felt it was the right place for me at that time, which I still believe it was a great place for me to kind of work on who I was as a saxophonist without a lot of pressure of being around a large studio of saxophonists.
Okay.
You know, and I mean, he taught at all 3 schools, so it didn't matter to him where I went. And it allowed me to kind of grow back into being the musician I was supposed to be to begin with. So I'm grateful for that opportunity. But I really credit Ken with believing in who I was and believing in my potential from the outset. Because he was the person I needed, and he has an innate ability to be able to figure out where his students' potentials and limits are and push up to that edge without going overboard. So I'm incredibly grateful for the opportunities that he gave me. And I know Ken very well. And if he hears that, he will say that I gave myself my own opportunities. But definitely a huge influence there. And so that's how I ended up getting back into music in New England. And I was already living here, finished my master's at Longy. I ended up leaving the IT world. I was self-employed for a number of years, working as an adjunct and teaching a large number of middle school and high school students on saxophone, upwards of 53 to 60 a week. And that's what I did for a long time, probably a dozen years over the course of finishing my master's, working on my doctorate and finishing that before I got this full-time opportunity at Fitchburg State.
I am always fascinated with and pleased to hear stories that are basically right place, right time.
Yes. You know what? I'm a huge believer in if something is not working out, there's a reason it's not working out. And, you know, a lot of people stick things out on that kind of sunk cost fallacy, or I've invested all this time here, I might as well finish. And I say, if you feel like you're in the wrong place academically, take a step back and figure out where you're supposed to be, because there's a better place for you.
Yeah. I could even amend that: right place, right time, right people.
Yes.
Because I've experienced those 3 in combination.
Right.
So Fitchburg State comes along, and you have described a little bit about what you're doing, but the thing that specifically has interested me from the moment that I first went to a concert over there was that the large ensembles over there, the band and the orchestra as well, are an interesting arrangement. They're an interesting combination of things. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so we have a large number of community members, non-students in our ensembles. When I was conducting the concert band at Salem State, my previous position, we were not scheduled in a time slot that would have allowed for community members to participate. So we always had some holes in the rehearsal process, and I would bring in some folks at the end to kind of fill out the voices that we needed. And when I was interviewing for the position at Fitchburg State, you know, they met in the evening, and right away it was clear to me there are quite a few community members. Some of those are alumni of that band, so they went to school there and have just stayed and played. We have a few current and former professors in the group.
Of music or of?
No, of different disciplines. Right now, I have a retired professor who plays saxophone in my group from the psychology department. So it really goes to show how important music is in people's lives. One of the questions I was asked by one of the band members was, you know, will you continue to allow community members to play in the ensemble? Mm. And I'm looking around and I'm like, yes, of course. Well, why would I not allow that? I mean, one, I won't have a band, but more importantly, you're in here playing, and that's what's important. You know, you're getting the opportunity to have music in your life. And, you know, one of the important aspects of our school is a focus on improving relations with the community and having the local community on our campus for programs and events. So I think this fulfills that quite nicely. The people who were there my first year are still there now in my sixth year. Can't believe that. And this year have picked up even more community members. So some of them are former band directors from around the area. So, you know, they want a place to play too. Yeah. At times, it can be difficult to try and pick repertoire because, you know, inevitably you have different levels of abilities. Mm-hmm. But I've never been sorry about raising the bar.
Yeah.
And I really rolled the dice on that last year, last summer. I picked out a program and I was like, you know, this is a lot of hard music. And I usually pick at least one or two harder pieces and a few that are a little bit more easily attainable. And they like that. They like having that challenge. But this fall, I said, you know what? I'm just going to do it and let's see what happens. And they rose to the occasion. And so I'm definitely not sorry. I've never been sorry for raising the bar on a group. And I think the key to success with that is letting them know, one, it's okay to make mistakes, but two, that you believe that they are capable of doing that. So yeah, that's the concert band. And, you know, the community orchestra is similar makeup where it's a large number of community members. You know, there are not a lot of string programs in central Massachusetts and secondary schools. So we actually have quite a few string players from the local community who are in secondary school who don't have a school orchestra to play in.
It strikes me that Fitchburg State, based on what I've been able to observe, is at least interested in moving the music thing forward. I mean, I was there for the event where you had a presentation about the acquisition of the new Steinway piano.
Oh, yes. And this long predates me. We have colleagues who have been working on this project for a long time, but we are very close to achieving our all Steinway status. But in order to do so, your pianos have to be at a certain condition. And the piano that we had in our main auditorium, while still quite serviceable, was also close to 50 years old. And when an institutional piano kind of reaches that age, you run out of room to actually be able to tune it. So when you're tuning the piano and screwing in the tuning pin, eventually you run out of space. You can't screw it in any further. So we're getting very close to that with that piano, that we were not going to be able to keep that piano in a condition that was acceptable for an all Steinway status. You know, there's a budget request process in academia that you have to go through for large purchases, and you dump your requests into this pool and it travels up a ladder along with every other department's requests, and they have some meetings and decide what they're going to spend this money on. We had a smaller piano as a Steinway Model B in that auditorium, but it wasn't really a big enough piano for that space. So every year we would submit our request for a Model D, which is the 9-foot concert grand, as our first choice, and as our backup, the B model. So if we can't get the one we really need, maybe we'll get one that we already have and replace it with that way. I mean, the difference in cost is a lot. It's almost double the price for the big one. And so we got a very miraculous email one summer that said the funding had been approved. And we were all like, no, it hasn't. This can't possibly be right. I mean, they're even more now. But at the time, that we got that piano a few years ago, a Model D is $180,000. Eventually, they said, nope, that's correct. We're going to fund this purchase. And we're still in shock. And so we said, well, we need to go to New York and pick it out. You'll have to fly us down there. And they said, okay. And we're like, what's going on? Like, really? So we went down there. And this is it during COVID. So we go down all masked up. And they took us on a full factory tour, which took well over an hour. We got to see every aspect of how the Steinway piano was put together. And I will just say that that is an amazing process. Nearly every aspect of those pianos is handmade by someone who specializes in that very task. So every little piece that goes in, there's someone that specializes in that.
The end of the foot.
Yes. And yes, it's a lot of money, but it is put together in exacting detail by hand. There is no mass-produced Steinway piano. Then we went into a selection room with five pianos, and we spent the afternoon picking out the piano that would sound the best in our auditorium. And they all were vastly different from each other. Some had a gigantic, bright sound, and some of them had a quieter, more mellow sound. We got the most versatile instrument we could out of that, and we love it. The support we have gotten from the administration for the arts over the past 5 or 6 years has been fantastic. When I came into my role as the band director, we were missing a lot of band inventory. We didn't have a lot of the percussion instruments that you need to play modern concert band music. And I made a gigantic list and I said, this is what we need. This is what we have that needs to be replaced. And here's the three items that can stay in the inventory. And this is before I even had my contract signed, you know. And I sent that up the ladder to my department chair, and I didn't hear anything for days. And I was like, they're going to rescind my contract. you know, he eventually sent me an email back. He said, I met with the dean, and we can't do it all right now, but we're going to work on it. And they did. They kept that promise. And over 3 years, we outfitted concert band with the percussion it needed. We replaced aging inventory that needed to be replaced. The support for music from the administration has been more than I could have ever hoped for. I'll just put it that way. And continues to be so. Even with a change in provost and dean structure, it's gotten even better, I will say.
I subbed in with your percussion section one evening and I was surrounded by gear.
Yes, you were. Yeah, we have all the gear now. Frankly, the only thing I'm missing is some items that no one needs to pay thousands of dollars for to play once every 6 years.
So I wasn't wrong. There's something afoot.
There's definitely things afoot. So it's an exciting time to be at Fitchburg State. Everything is growing. You know, I did also want to talk about my jazz band.
Cool.
When I first got there, had a few students in it. And I found out that, you know, we have a lot of students who play instruments at Fitchburg State, but a lot of students are afraid to join a college band because they think they're not good enough. So I kind of started a little campaign and I took more of a modern band approach with the jazz band, where I take anyone on any instrument at any level. The students pick the music each semester. They come in with a list. We listen, they vote, and then we arrange for the level of our band. And you have done a couple of my arrangements when I did not have the time to do them, and they were fantastic. Thank you. So, you know, sometimes I have a really weird ensemble instrumentation. One semester I had three guitarists and a flute. But the advantage is the students are invested because they're playing the music that they picked out.
Yeah.
And they teach each other.
And they know you're not going to hang them out to dry.
That's right.
Yeah.
So I have three guitarists. Yeah, it's a lot of guitarists. But guess what? One of them is a beginner, and maybe he can only manage to play one chord per measure.
Sure.
And that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe one of the other guitarists is more advanced, and they can teach the others more chords. They can teach them other chord voicings. They love working together. So it's been a really good success. And I've never been sorry that I took on this format. I mean, right now I have a flutist and a trumpet and a French horn player. Two drummers and a pianist, and they sound great.
I did time with sitting at the piano with my drum set kid over there and my French horn guy over there and my banjo player over there, and we said, what can we play? And to this day, I don't remember whether it was the French horn kid, Ryan, or Steve, the banjo player, who looked at me and said, pong, pong, king, gong, gong, French horn, wah-da-da-da-da-da. It was the first thing we played, and then And then we played bluegrass with French horn, and you do what you got to do. But right, it's a situation where everybody is contributing ideas about things. And certainly in my case, and I know in your case, they trusted that we weren't going to give them stuff that was going to embarrass them in public.
Yeah, you give them stuff that's reachable for them, and they trust you. And, you know, that kind of mutual relationship is what helps build bands.
So now you're getting your groups, he says, deftly pivoting to a current event, which we want to put out into the world and let people know about, that as this podcast goes out on Monday, the 22nd of April, 3 evenings later, you're doing a concert with your band and orchestra that involves a guest artist.
On April 25th, we have booked ourselves a guest artist, and that guest artist is New England trumpeter Jay Daly, who does a terrific show called History of the Popular Trumpet. It is a medley of popular tunes from early jazz through the Great American Songbook to kind of late 70s chart toppers that all have fabulous trumpet solos in them. We are so looking forward to working with him. And I got to tell you that the band was a little nervous when I proposed this. I said, this is what we're going to do. And they're like, I said, this is when we're going to rehearse with him. One rehearsal, and then, you know, we'll do the performance. And they're like, can we get more rehearsals? Nope.
You get one
shot. You won't need them. That's what I told them. I was like, you won't need more rehearsals with him. It'll be fine.
And oh, by the way, his resume includes he's played with everybody.
Oh, yes.
He's played in bands that backed Sinatra and...
Yes. He has quite a resume. He has an amazing sound. And, you know, I knew of Jay for many years, but I had never worked with him until... probably the last few years, actually did some pit orchestra work at some high school shows with him. I was asking him about, you know, this history of the popular trumpet thing that he'd been doing. He's like, oh yeah. He goes, you know, I'd love to come out and do it with your concert band. I was like,
except now and figure it out later.
Right. I ran into him again in the fall and I said, hey, you still want to do this? He's like, yeah, let's do it. I was like, are you free on this date? Cause I already have my concert date set. And he's like, yep, I'm free. We'll figure out a dress rehearsal. I said, sounds good. Not only is he a great performer, he's also a great person. And as a former school music teacher himself, he gets it.
Okay.
You know, he wants to give students an opportunity that they might not have. He's a good clinician. He's a good teacher. And he is willing to work with anybody.
He's not too cool for the room.
Exactly. But yeah, we're so looking forward to it. The concert's free. Weston Auditorium, April 25th at 7:30 p.m.
Before we finish up, I can offer you what has come to be my customary set of less resume band questions. First one up is always, what's one of your favorite band pieces of music that you've played, whether it's outdoors or indoors or wherever?
My favorite is the March from Hindemith's Symphonic Metamorphosis. I love playing it. I love listening to it. I love conducting it in my living room and in my car.
Yes, of course.
I have listened to every single concert band recording of this and could give you a complete analysis of what I like and don't like about each one of them. This is definitely my favorite. But a really close second is Omar Thomas's A Mother of a Revolution. Love that piece. It's so powerful on so many levels. It's so well written. And has such a strong message.
That was one of the ones that was on the program when I subbed in on the bass drum, probably.
Last fall, yes.
So on the flip side, what's a piece of band music that you've never played, but you would like to?
I would really like to play Julie Giroux's new symphony, Big Blue Marble. I love her music. I love her writing. I love her as a person. It is a really cool new piece of music with a accompanying video. Yes.
One of my last two questions that I always ask, tell me one of your favorite band stories.
I've got a few favorites, and most of them are from my time with the Gator Band in Florida. I'll leave out names. We had a graduate assistant who would take the pep band to the away basketball games, and this person was quite notorious for leaving band members at rest stops if they weren't back on the bus in time. And this is before anyone had a cell phone. So if you got left, you couldn't call and say, hey guys, you left me. You had to get some stranger to give you a ride in their car and chase down the bus on the highway and get them to pull over, you know. So one night they were late coming back to the bus and the pep band left her.
Ooh.
Karma.
Yeah.
There's some karma for you. You know, this is what happens when you disrespect your band. They don't have any respect for you either. It is a funny story. somewhat. I can't imagine ever leaving a student behind somewhere. I mean, yeah, we're all adults. It's one thing if you miss the bus on campus. It's another thing when you're, 300 miles away from campus. No phone.
So I don't know whether we may have covered this just now, but have you got a favorite band life lesson or a bit of wisdom that you found useful, either outside a band or in?
I do, and we haven't covered it, and it actually comes from George Parks. I attended his drum major camp a few times when I was in high school, and one of his big sayings was, "Don't go to your band director with a problem if you don't have two solutions ready to give them at the same time." And I think this is true in any workplace. You sub out the word band director for manager or supervisor, you've got good job and life advice. Be part of the solution, not part of the problem. No one just wants to hear a complaint. I have one other life lesson that I learned from Dave Waybright at the University of Florida. If you're taking a band on an overnight trip, make sure you're staying in a place with easy access for the band to have something to do that night. Because if they're busy having a good time outside the hotel, they won't wreck the inside of the hotel.
I am guessing that there are a number of podcast listeners that are nodding their heads vigorously.
Yeah, the last thing you want is for your group to have a reputation of wrecking hotels.
I remember being the graduate assistant of our mutual brass playing acquaintance, and we were overnight at a hotel somewhere. I was on the bus counting heads, and he came out the hotel with his paperwork, and he got on the bus and said, "Well, they want to have us back." At the time, I think I did not have enough experience on the leadership end of a band bus trip that involved a hotel, but I very quickly figured out what he meant.
Yeah, it's worth it.
You don't want to call a hotel and tell them who you are and have them say, I got to wash my socks that night.
Sorry, full up.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as you get off the phone with them, they're calling the next hotel to give them a heads up.
And one last important thing, which is not one of my usual end questions, but it could be, I guess. If a hypothetical listener wanted hypothetically to learn more about you and your projects, where could they hypothetically find you online?
Yes, well, in reality, they can find me online at mclaughlinmusic.com. They can also go to fitchburgstate.edu and do a search for me there. There's information there with our bands and events that are coming up.
Conductor, educator, saxophonist, bagpiper. We didn't talk that much about that. Amy McLaughlin, thanks so much for taking time for this conversation. What a blast.
Thanks, Rob. I've been looking forward to this for so long. I really appreciate the opportunity.
All right, one last pause and then we'll head for the finish line. Thanks so much, everybody, for continuing to listen. Here comes the dogfight. This week's dogfight is brought to you by Facebook Memories and the fact that Mr. Zuckerberg's online creation can remind us daily what we were doing 1, 2, 3, 5, 10, 15 years ago. In this case, Facebook recently offered me a memory from 4 years ago, and you know what that means. In brief, which this week I am, it was about a month into the COVID-19 lockdowns when many of us were wondering what band was going to look like on the other side of this thing, if there even was going to be anything on the other side of it. The memory that I was offered was this Facebook status update post of my own. My iTunes just played me the Boston Pops rendition of Stars and Stripes Forever, and something unusual happened as they got past the last dogfight and into the big finish, aka the company front. I got thinking about how, enthusiastically, a lot of bands and orchestras are going to play once we're able to gather in groups again, just because they can gather and play again. And I got all choked up. He got emotional over Stars and Stripes? You mean Scars and Scrapes? Moans and Gripes? The most played Sousa March ever? Borderline cliché? Yup. I'm okay now. But again, man, when this is over. Just a gentle reminder that no matter how much more work we've got to do with our bands before our next concert, no matter how much reeds cost, no matter how much our band's various personalities sometimes bang up against each other, for the most part, right now, once again, we can gather in groups and play our band tunes. And a gentle reminder that we should work hard not to take that for granted. That's it. That's the tweet. Okay, one last fermata, and then we'll wrap things up for this week. Thanks for continuing to listen. To close this week, let's take the coda. For the coda this week, a brief reminder about last week's call to action. For an episode sometime next month, I'm wondering if you've got a graduation or commencement band story you want to share, or a story about a particular graduating band senior whom you've known, or whom you've been. Funny, serious, whatever it is, I'd love to have you send it in an email or as a voicemail, and in mere seconds, I'll remind you how to do that. That's Bandwagon for this week. Thanks, as always, for downloading and listening. Bandwagon was written, researched, and produced by your humble host. Musical interludes were produced by Hammerton Media, from source material largely by John Philip Sousa. You can listen to more episodes at our website, heyband.podbean.com. Please give me feedback, be polite, but let me know what you like, what you think might change. Tell me your best band story, or suggest a topic for a future episode. Whatever you like. You can do that using our email address, heybandwagon@yahoo.com, or leave us a 90-second voice message by going to speakpipe.com/heybandwagon. Be aware that we do reserve the right to include your message on the podcast, unless you say otherwise. All those contact links and links to our news items, conversation topics, and my interview guest, Dr. Amy McLaughlin, can be found in our show notes. Please share the show on social media, and thank you for that. If you enjoy this podcast, get someone else to listen as well. Word of mouth is the best recruiting tool. And to keep up with us every week, subscribe to Bandwagon on the Podbean app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please give us a 5-star review. It really helps other people to find the show. For now, take care, stay in touch, stay in tune, and we'll do this all again next week. I'm Rob Hammerton, and remember, a timpani is not a table.